That was Duke Ellington's Black and Tan Fantasy, performed by Don Byron on clarinet and Arwan Ortiz on piano. It comes from the album Random Dances and Atonalities from 2018, and Don Byron is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance Podcast, which is part of the OSIRIS Network. If you enjoy the show, I hope you'll consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and there are benefits to joining, including getting to read exclusive excerpts from my book Ugly Beauty, Jazz in the 21st Century, which will be published in January. So become a subscriber if you can. Don Byron is originally from the Bronx, and he was kind of a fixture on the downtown music scene in the late 80s and early 90s. His first album as a leader, Tuskegee Experiments, came out almost 30 years ago in 1992. It featured a variety of musicians, including guitarist Bill Frisell, two different bassists, Reggie Workman and Lonnie Plaxico, and two different drummers, Fearon Akloff and Ralph Peterson. A year after that, he released Don Byron Plays the Music of Mickey Katz, an album of klezmer music that shaped his public image maybe more strongly than he might have liked, as you'll understand when you listen to this conversation. The thing with Byron is every one of his records is completely different from the others. He seems to always be deeply invested in exploring a concept, and once he's done that on record, he moves on. He's not one of those musicians who establishes a working band and takes them into the studio every year or two. When Don Byron makes a record, it's because he's got something very particular to say at that moment, and when he's done, he's said all he has to say on that subject. And as a result, his albums require you to really be willing to put the time in and think about what he's saying and why. That's not to suggest that the music isn't enjoyable on a purely sensory level. It is. He's a great clarinet player and a really fascinating composer. But he wants you to think about why someone might make the kind of music they make, instead of just taking it or taking anything for granted. I don't want to say much more. I just want you to hear the conversation we had. I should warn you that about 28, 29 minutes into our talk, Don Byron drops an N-bomb with a hard R while making a point about what is and what isn't jazz, what is and what isn't black music, etc. That's basically the subject we spend this entire hour circling around, because his instrument, the composers whose work he explores, and all of that are in kind of blurry territory where, as he says, it's not considered real jazz sometimes. Which is, on the one hand, bullshit, because jazz is whatever a jazz musician plays, but on the other hand, genre distinctions are meaningless anyhow, right? That's how we end up talking about Biz Markie and Kirk Franklin and Fishbone and all the other stuff that we talk about in this interview. So I'm going to play another piece of music now. This is a version of Raymond Scott's Powerhouse from Byron's 1996 album Bug Music. You know this piece, whether you know it from Bugs Bunny cartoons or somewhere else. So enjoy his version of it, which is very enjoyable, and then you'll hear my interview with Don Byron. You played a gig not long ago. That's what inspired me to call you for an interview, is I saw, I got an email that you played a gig up near you. So how was that?
Well, yesterday, Sunday, I played in Hudson, and there were a couple other bands, a pianist I didn't know, and then this Matthew Shipp group with Matt Minieri and some bass player, you know, so there were a couple nice kind of nice groups, you know, and they had, it was a very nice event, and free to the public in a very nice park that sat right on the Hudson, so that was really terrific.
Mm-hmm.
So that was Sunday.
And was that the only one, or was there another one that was at the Falcon or something like that, or was this put
on? I played
on
at the Falcon the weekend before, a week before I played at the Falcon, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So how many people were coming out for these things, and how did it feel?
Well, the Falcon has, you know, it's not like they're at 100% seating quite yet, so there are like actual limits about how many people can be in the room. So I don't know how many there were in the room, but it was just that number. The thing outside, there were, you know, hundreds of people there. It was a very nice event. They had a DJ later. People were dancing. It was a very nice event. They were selling art. There was a store selling very nice Caribbean food. It was happening.
Cool. And who was your group? Who were you playing with?
Well, the other Sunday it was with Farona Glop and Arlen Ortiz and Brad Jones. And last week it was Drew Gress, David Gilmore, and Ben Porowski.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Now, I know you've worked with Arwan before, and I know you've worked with Farone before on albums and stuff. Are either of those kind of working bands? Or, you know, I mean, there's no working bands right now because there's nobody working, but, you know, are either of those, like, regular ensembles for you?
Well, I mean, they're regular people that I've done shit with over the years and can call them in various combinations, you know? I mean, well, all of those people, I've just done a lot of shit over the years. And Porowski and Drew Gress are really kind of upstate guys. You know, they live up here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've done all kinds of little dumbass gigs at restaurants and stuff around, you know, in the area with Porowski. And David lives up here too. He lives right in Woodstock, in fact. So there's a little community. I mean, years ago there was a different kind of community that was more like Jack Bissonette and Pat Metheny, and you know, there was that Carla Bley, and some of those people are still around, but you know, these are more people of my era.
Mm. Yeah, it seems like there are a couple of there are some sort of quiet little mini scenes that exist around, you know, around New York and New Jersey. I mean, there's a whole bunch of players in like Maplewood, New Jersey, you know, and you know, a couple other towns where just a ton of people
Montclair.
Live. Montclair, yeah.
Montclair, like that's is that Hamia Blewett, Reggie Workman, Farona Glob, you know, Oliver Lake. All these people had cribs in Montclair.
Yeah, exactly. Christian McBride, I think, is over there too. You know, it's yeah, there's a ton of people. So how did you feel, you know, getting out and playing? Did you feel like you were in shape? Like, how much did you practice before these two gigs?
Well, I mean, you know, I've been practicing. I haven't not been practicing, but I mean, I played all through the pandemic different things. I had gigs last summer. We played very super distance kind of things. I remember we played at the Mass Mocha in the middle of last summer, but the super distance event. So, I mean, I've had shit canceled, obviously, but, you know, within the limits, I've been somewhat active. I would say super active. I mean, last summer, you know, right up until it got too cold to play outside, people were playing outdoors at the Falcon. And then things got worse and the indoor thing didn't happen quite right away. But I mean, this is just to say, I mean, whatever little things could be done in the area, I felt very good about doing them, you know,
mm-hmm.
And keeping some kind of activity going and keeping, you know, having people that want to hear me, they can hear me, you know? You know, the question is what are we opening up to? You know, if things open up, what are we opening up to?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, some people have been going to Europe kind of early on, but, every country in Europe is a completely different situation. I don't know how I feel about that, you know? It's like, you know, like they had Sweden for a while, just decided not to do anything, right? They were going to go for herd immunity. So, like, you know, certain places in Europe, you know, you don't know what they're doing, how vaccinated they are. So it's, I don't know. I think it's going to be a while before things are the way that they used to be.
Yeah. I have friends who say, I'll see you in 2022. I'm not, not screwing around. But
Well, I mean, I think air travel has been proven to be okay, but I haven't taken a plane trip since this started.
Yeah, exactly. Whether it's safe or not, the big problem now with air travel seems to be putting up with people who've just become huge assholes all of a sudden. Like every flight has one screaming jackass being dragged off in handcuffs.
I think people, what people have to admit is this shit made a lot of people crazy. crazier than they would have been, crazier than they are. It's really, through the whole thing, there was this whole like Republican denying kind of thing. And that was definitely insanity, but there's also just people acting a little more agitated and acting out and people attacking people, no reason. That's this too.
So I kind of want to ask you about a bunch of things. So I guess I should just start at the beginning, which is what initially drew you to the clarinet? What do you like about it? Why do you think that's the instrument that reflects your voice creatively?
Well, my uncle played the clarinet that I started on. And when I started playing it, I had some childhood asthma, and that was suggested, and I got a good sound on it. But I mean, the main thing for me was that my dad really grew up hearing this very good clarinetist that my dad played. He was the leader of the band. They played calypso music, which my dad played bass in. And so I always had the idea that, like, that there was black clarinet. Like, that was an idea that I think people tried to drum out of me, that there was anything to achieve on the instrument, that anyone has achieved anything on the instrument, but I witnessed that. So I just stayed with it, and even when I explored other instruments, I've just stayed with it. There is this thing in the clarinet pedagogy of like trying to get black musicians to get off the clarinet and play the saxophone and be themselves. And it's a very kind of hard thing to resist. And then there's jazz clarinet itself, which most people don't associate with black musicians. They associate it with the white swing era guys. And so to stay with the clarinet, you have to face both of those things down, that a lot of people, white and black, don't really see it, the clarinet, as a place of black achievement. It's not a site of black achievement like the saxophone, like the electric bass, like things that people believe that black people can do. It's not on that list.
Mm-hmm.
So it's challenging.
Yeah. I think in the present day, it's kind of, in the last couple of years, there's been a little bit more of a resurgence because Shabaka Hutchings plays, and he's known as a saxophonist, but he always says the clarinet is his primary instrument, and he studied it classically. Yeah, I mean,
he's a good clarinet player. I met him when he was a kid.
Oh, yeah?
And, in the UK, like, I'd have a gig, and, the promoters would bring him to hang out with me, it's been a while since I've seen him, but I like a lot of things he was doing, and that kind of crazy Afro-y sounding group he has, the Sons of Tenet or some shit like that, that sounds like Afro pop going wrong. He's done a lot of interesting things. I saw some shit, him playing a Copland concerto. He's doing good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's the same way. He doesn't draw that boundary between, this is classical, this is jazz, this is music from Barbados, you know, which is where he's from. He's just like, it's all, you know, it's all, there's a room for all of it, basically, you know. Which, so how did you develop your interest in klezmer music? Because that's really kind of key to your whole thing.
Well, it's not key to my whole thing, but you know, the short answer is, you know, I went to the third string department at New England Conservatory. That's where my degree is from. And that program is like Wesleyan, it's like Bard College, it's like Bennington, it's like Mills College. It was an experimental music program which included ethnic musics like Indian music, Greek music, Jewish music, included a lot of free improvisation. On paper, it included like normal jazz and classical music, but it was really a program like where people made music in the experimental banner, not really having to be professionally good at anything, but they could try a lot of different things. But the Klezmer Conservatory band that I was in came kind of out of the third string department. You know, also around New England Conservatory at the time, Joe Maneri was there, so there was always Greek music. You know, and Gunther, while he was, you know, I mean, everybody knows that Gunther experimented with a lot of different musics while he was at New England. He had bands playing ragtime, country fiddling, shit like that, had conservatory students studying those things. So klezmer music was just something that caught on that we studied at that place. But I studied a lot of other things at that place too. I studied with this great woodwind teacher, Joe Allard. I studied with privately and in classes with George Russell, who's jazz's great composer theorist. So there were a lot of other things happening besides klezmer music, but klezmer music was just one of the things that was happening.
And when you made your first record, Tuskegee Experiments, well, first of all, how did you get signed to Nonesuch?
Well, I mean, somebody signed me and then I did a record. I don't know. What are you asking? How
Well, I
did I
mean,
get signed?
like,
Is it
was
such
it?
a miracle?
Well, I didn't know how it worked back then because I'm from a few years after that. So, I mean, were you playing at the Knit and somebody was like, you know, I want to make a record with this band that you've got, you know, or what was the, or did somebody endorse you? Like, what was the story?
I think Bob Herb, which came to several gigs I played at places besides the Knitting Factory. And I was already playing with Bill Frisell. You know, I mean, I was a downtown musician. I mean, you know, I guess I'm always reduced to being, you know, a black jazz musician. I was playing with Mark Rebo. I was playing with Vernon Reid. I was playing with Bill Frisell. And really exchange with those people like we were playing in each other's groups. So, you know, I was a known commodity to people that followed a certain element of what was happening at the time. I was playing in the Reggie Workman Ensemble. I was playing in the Ellington Band. I was still playing with Mario Bauza when I got signed. I was playing shows. You know, subbing on Broadway shows. I was doing all kinds of things. So, I played in the Ellington Band for a couple of years. So I'm not like, you know, how did I get signed? I don't really see it that way. You know, the reason, I mean, I had something contemporary to say on an instrument that jazz had essentially given up for dead. So, that's how I got signed.
So when you call an album Tuskegee Experiments, it's immediately sort of like you're, in a way, it's like you're telling the listener, I'm not necessarily here to entertain you. Like this is, there's socially engaged music with, you know, with a message to it. So what was the response at the time from critics and from the community? when you, you know, when you put that record out?
Well, it depends on what community you ask. I mean, you know, most people that follow jazz clarinet, they come at it in a very white-centric way. You're talking Goodman and Shaw, stuff like that. So people like that, they probably wouldn't have so much been into somebody trying to say those kinds of things. This is before Black Lives Mattered. So saying those kind of things, you know, to somebody that didn't want to hear them with their jazz clarinet, they might not listen to me. So it was that kind of thing. But it was, my music was about being an African-American, West Indian American kid. I grew up in New York. You know, when Trump sent that letter, like, about the Central Park Five, he was basically writing about me. That was what it was like to grow up as a young Black man in New York at that time. It was like, you know, like the woman in Central Park that freaked out at the bird watcher guy, you know, like New York was just like that.
Mm-hmm.
All over. And so I was writing about I was writing music about my reality. So I really think I got that idea in retrospect from Gary Bartz, who always made music about, you know, what he was thinking about, what his experiences, you know, his love of Malcolm X, you know, I mean, that was in his music. So I was trying to be like that, but in a period where I think people were fairly apolitical.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of the early 90s as you didn't have the groups of people picketing and protesting and stuff like we had a year or two ago. You didn't really see that. It wasn't a time of organized activism. So I was putting my viewpoint out there, writing music about Diego Rivera, you know, things like that that mattered to me politically.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel? And so you were saying, you know, some people that weren't necessarily into it would just kind of ignore it. So, I mean, were you greeted with kind of a stiff arm from critics, or did you receive reviews that you thought were unfair, or what, you know, how was it received, like, for the people that did write?
Well, I mean, I would have to go back and look. I don't think my problem was really critics, because, you know, the album was fairly well received and it has a lot of great music on it. You know, that album, just somebody that was like into like Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw, they wouldn't even pick up that album. That's the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
That somebody, I think a lot of people that approached the music white centrically, their approach at the time was that, you know, what else could that be but avant-garde music? That couldn't be real jazz clarinet. That's not real. You know, that's what Eddie Daniels would say about my music. That's not really real. You know?
Yeah. So that band, the band on that first record, had Bill Frisell, had Lonnie Plaxico, and Ralph Peterson was on there. And mm-hmm. you had quite a relationship with him, because you were in his fauxtet also. So,
well, Ralph and I met early on when I was subbing in the David Murray Octet, and we just knew that we could play together. And then we both were in these Craig Harris bands, you know, touring, you know, when Craig had some work. I mean, it would be like real tours, and, you know, 5-6 week tours. And we got to know each other very well. And we would sit around in the car of the train and sing along to Joe Henderson solos and Freddie Hubbard solos. I mean, you know, all the Young Lion shit was happening, but we kind of acknowledged that it had a conservative feel to it that we didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tried to make music that was more out of the raunchy side of of the Blue Note thing, you know, like a record like Free For All or something like that. That's really got some composition to it, but it's a little wild.
Yeah.
We didn't think that the Young Lions guys of that time had the wildness that the people that they studied had in 1968. And that was another reason why, for me, the politics were important, because a lot of what made that music powerful, that 60s Freddie Hubbard, McCoy Tyners, you know, it was the environment, the political environment that was around all black people at the time. So I think Ralph and I just, we tried to get to that. But then, you know, I had this exposure with the downtown scene and that kind of sound. And I think he learned how to incorporate that sound into his sound. I mean, it really, the Fotet sounds a lot like that. And, you know, my stuff with Frizzell, I mean, you know, that's a lot of the people in jazz that understood downtown music were in, you know, would be me, Frizzell, and Ralph.
Mm-hmm. It's funny what you say about Free For All, because I remember I was talking to Don Was, the head of Blue Note, about that record and the way it was just recorded like an explosion. I mean, it's so loud and so, you know, Blakey's drums are so huge and distorted. It's crazy. And
you hear the cats like hollering in that record.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
when the shit's really good, you hear the cats like hollers, ooh, you know, like you really feel the spirit of the time in those moments that are a little wilder than some of the other moments. And so I think we just thought that the Young Lions shit was, you know, it was okay that the Young Brothers were studying that music, but you didn't have to go so three-piece suit with it, you know?
Yeah.
It didn't have to sound so three-piece suit as it sounded.
It's funny because it kind of reminds me of the punk band X, right?
Yeah.
Their lead guitarist was just a complete, you know, just stole all his licks from Chuck Berry, basically. But if you go back and listen to the Chuck Berry records from the 50s, they're dirtier than the punk records from the late 70s and early 80s.
Mm.
Like, Chuck Berry has a nastier tone, has, like, you know, he sounds more punk than Billy Zoom from X. So it always makes me laugh, you know, to think about how the second generation, in a way, kind of cleans things up.
Mm. Well, I think, you know, also, like, when, you know, in the 90s, a lot of the old cats were still alive, you know, and they didn't want the music, you know, they were used to playing the music in a certain tone, in a certain kind of tone, just not completely... not youthful. They were used to playing it in non-youthful tone, let's say. You know, if you played with those older musicians, they played in a different tone than we played amongst ourselves. You know, like Smitty, I remember he was playing with Art Farmer, and they, you know, that was in a certain tone. Then, you know, when I played with Smitty, that was in another kind of tone.
So, I was, the other night when I was preparing questions for this, I was reading the liner notes to your album Bug Music, and I found some of what you said there kind of fascinating, because you were talking about how critics, jazz critics, get thrown off the track by through-composed music. And then you were also talking more broadly about how porous the boundaries between jazz and chamber music or modern composition or whatever can be. And this is something that I've talked about with Tyshawn Sorey and with Anthony Braxton and Roscoe Mitchell as well, is the idea that the more closely you listen, the more arbitrary and even like meaningless those divisions become. You know?
Mm.
So, I mean, is that what you were kind of pursuing on that record? Kind of taking these early jazz compositions and showing them as compositions?
First of all, at that time, like the Raymond Scott stuff was getting play, but like in a downtowny kind of way. And, you know, like where downtown groups were playing like skronky versions of Raymond Scott and Raymond Scott Project and the Raymond Scott this and the Raymond Scott that. But they wouldn't be necessarily linking the Raymond Scott group to the John Kirby group. And they wouldn't be seeing both of those groups as an expression of Ellington. That was, to me, what I was really trying to say. But on the other hand, Gunther, who, you know, I'm very grateful to him for having started the Third Stream and all the stuff he did at the school, but in his book, he completely disses John Kirby. And John Kirby was really one of the predecessors to the bebop shit. You know, John Kirby was the group that Ben Webster like wrote himself a part in so he could play in, that Dizzy played in John Kirby's group. And you know, Miles talks about seeing Dizzy playing in John Kirby's group in interviews. He says he saw that. So, I mean, this was a group that people really wanted to be in. But then, you know, here comes somebody outside the music who just decides, well, that shit ain't real. It's not really black enough. That shit ain't got enough nigger in it that it's authentically anything. And I think it just, you know, when I was working on Mickey Katz's music, there were like certain people in Klezmer, it's like, oh, well, that's not the real shit and whatever it is, you know, and it's like, whatever something is, it really is what it is. It's not up to people after the fact to say this shit isn't correctly black or correctly Jewish or fully jazz or, you know, it's just a kind of after the fact thing, because the truth of the matter is the John Kirby group was one of the most successful black bands and a lot of black people loved it. You know, it's just so the kind of after the after analysis, I think, really offended me.
Mm.
You know, when I met, you know, Marion McPartland, she immediately started telling me stories about hearing that group and how great that group was and how great Billy Kyle was. You know, when you talk to old cats who are around there, everybody, you know, nobody has a bad word to say. So how does it get to be that somebody just decides that something isn't the real shit, and then they get to disseminate that, you know, in a book that people would use as a textbook? That's not nice.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was reading a book a couple of years ago. Bob Porter, the DJ and producer, wrote this book on soul jazz, and he talked about, you know, the difference between jazz that was actually listened to in the black community versus jazz that was listened to downtown by white critics, you know, and this division went all the way back to like the 1940s and 50s, you know, and it becomes the, you know, an entire historical narrative gets built up. I mean, you know, Kirby is just like written out of history at this point, you know?
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, I put him back a little bit. But because, you know, that's when you talk about sampling, I mean, it's the Kirby shit that gets sampled. There's what's the name of that? This is one of these big romantic comedies that they use some of my Kirby in. Oh, Serendipity with who's in that?
Oh, the John Cusack movie. Yeah.
John Cusack. Yeah. Yeah. There's, you know, I mean, that is some of the music that gets the most usage is the Kirby from that record. So, I just feel, you know, it was a point that I wanted to make curatorially. And You know, like, that's the thing you're not supposed to do as a black musician, is make some kind of curatorial statement, and everybody's like, aha, the postulate has been formed. You know, like, that's like a white person's job. But that's what I thought I was doing by doing that, and that's what I thought I was doing by playing Mickey Katz's music. Uh-huh. I was making curatorial statements about what's hip, what's not, how things are seen, how they really are, you know, how people think about things and what's really there.
And, I mean, I guess the Junior Walker record as well would be sort of part of the same kind of thinking.
Yes and no. I mean, you know, I was just, that was the music that I was interested in at the time. I was really interested in it. So, I don't know if I was trying to be curatorial with it. It was just the music that I was really interested in working on.
You were part of the ensemble on the Hal Wilner record, Weird Nightmare, the Mingus tribute record, which is...
Yeah, I did a few things with Hal, yeah.
Which was probably the strangest and darkest of his whole series of tribute records. And it's one of my favorites. So, I mean, I'm curious what your memories are of making that record and of working with Hal. Like, what was he like in the studio and stuff like that?
Man, he was just off getting high, you know? He didn't really do anything. I mean, you know, he would just get a lot of really good musicians together and just throw you in the pit, you know. One of the tunes that I played on, I wrote the chart for everybody to read, because there was, you know, he just said, why don't we play such and such and such? Nobody had a chart for it, you know. It was just, so it was kind of like that. If you get a whole bunch of famous rock guys and you throw them together with a whole bunch of famous jazz guys, you throw them together with this and you throw them together with that, you will get something. I mean, you know, you have to have a big budget to make those kind of records, because there's a lot of, like, tape rolling, not knowing what's going to happen kind of thing. And that's really what I remember. But he didn't, you know, I mean... All I remember about him the days I was there was he was just there getting high. He was a guy that facilitated a lot of shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he knew people, he had access to money, he could make certain kinds of things happen. I mean, just having those Harry Parch instruments around, I mean, you need to be on the inside to make some shit like that happen.
So... Tell me the story, because on your new Blaxploitation album, there's that long live track with Biz Markie. How did that come together? Tell me the story about that show.
Well, it was a live show that I did with the intention of getting some material. You know, like, I really didn't, you know, like, sometimes people would say that recording, that Blaxploitation thing, was like hip-hop. And it really wasn't hip-hop. It was trying to, you know, get to a sophisticated kind of spoken word thing. Because at the time, you know, the spoken word bands that I heard, either the music wasn't good or the spoken word wasn't good. But very seldom did I hear things that where I thought, the music is really good and the words are really good. And so I was trying to do that. But then, you know, if there was a hip hop guy that I really related to, I just loved the Biz. And I did a few more things with him. I don't know if he's even, you know, I hear he's been very sick, like in the hospital with some shit. But, you know, like, the funny thing about the Biz is, like, his music just, you know, you hear that Got What I Need shit everywhere now, beer commercials and shit like that. And he really had something. He could really, like, his version of Benny and the Jets that he did on Chris Rock show is one of the great moments ever. I just think he was a very gifted. He knew a little more about music than he was supposed to. I mean, I think even some of his hits, he played the little dumbass keyboard shit on there. But I also think at the sound check to one of the gigs I did after the recording, we're sitting there at the sound check, and he sung Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World. Like, he sung the whole thing, the phrasing, he knew the words. That was his sound check. And we were all like, just the cast were just like, holy shit, this motherfucker actually knows something. He knows something. Because he really does know something. And I think that his lack of singing, you know, in a traditional way in terms of sound, it almost links him with like the Brazilian bossa nova guys that can't sing, or Johnny Cash or Ernest Tubb or something like that. He's like the black version of that. But he is a singer. And every time I played a live gig with him, he's a great performer. He gets in front of a crowd, it's all fucking over. I just like working with him. But he was always my favorite, like him and the Tribe. To me, of my era, him, Tribe Called Quest, that's really where my love of hip hop starts. I mean, I love the Sugar Hill music, and you know, actually had a project where I transcribed a whole bunch of like Sugar Hill music, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five and the Terrible Two, and so that part of the hip hop, the early industrialized hip hop, I kind of like that too. But to me, the Biz, just in terms of the person he was, he was like vulnerable. He was just a great artist. He's just a great artist. So you know, I can't say he's a personal friend of mine. We don't be hanging out and shit. But you know, he did some gigs that I got, and I enjoyed doing them with him, and all the musicians did too.
Mm-hmm. Some of those guys, like the guys in hip hop that are regarded as sort of clownish, will often surprise people. Like, I mean, I remember reading that Flavor Flav from Public Enemy plays like 10 instruments. That he's like a seriously trained musician and knows all this shit and developed the persona, and now, you know, like no one can see behind the mask in a way, you know, but he's actually like a heavy, you know, instrumentalist when he wants to be.
I mean, you don't even need to play to have good taste. And I think the Tribe guys just had such good taste. Everything that they sample, every sound that they made was made in absolute good taste. It's not like, you know, people just put something up against the beat and it, you know, if it makes the hips move, it's a good track. Like, the Tribe tracks are tasty. They had very good taste. The Biz was more, for me, he was more just the person that could admit that, you know, everybody in hip hop couldn't admit any vulnerability. You know, if they wanted a girl, they got her. If they wanted some money, they made it. You know, it was all about invincibility. And then he was just not really like that. You know, he was a little more a vulnerable person. And I really respect him for having done that. He's been great on children's programming. You know, he had some runs on some children's TV. He was superb. That's really him, you know. And, you know, I don't have anything but good things to say about the Biz. He's a bad cat. He's really a genius of something, yeah. Whatever that is. He's a genius of it.
You, in 2011, you put out an album of gospel songs with D.K. Dyson from the Black Rock Coalition on vocals. What was the impetus behind that project? Was that something that, you know, like the Junior Walker record, where it's just that's what you were into at the time? Or was it, you know, what was going on with that?
Well, first of all, I'm a member of the Black Rock Coalition and always have been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, DK, you know, I had this group that out of symphony space, where we were doing these kind of orchestral things, we did, one where there was all Sugar Hill. We did one that was Henry Mancini and Earth, Wind & Fire. We did one that was Stravinsky and Raymond Scott. And, she was, we just really started working together in that, just doing versions of different kinds of music. And so we had kind of bonded from that. And I just wanted to play some Thomas Dorsey material because I think it's really important music that, every black musician certainly should know those songs. I mean, the lyrics to them are just like great poetry and very self-revealing. And, he's a songwriter that really puts his faith on the line in every song. Like, what is it? How do you do it? How do you think about it? It's all on the line for him in any song that he's ever written. And he also was an interesting man who just went through a lot of trials and tribulations, nervous breakdown, and he really invented this combination of the blues and black religious material. He really invented that, that people don't really want to think that, that people kind of think that, like, the way the black worship shit is today, it was always that way. There was a lot of resistance to what he did in his day, A lot of churches threw him out and didn't want to hear about it and really preferred a more anglicized version of black religious music.
Mm-hmm.
So he really fought and endured a lot of intra-black resistance to what he's doing. I mean, you'd never know it now, but I mean, and out of that, that's a tradition that gave us all of the pop singers to come. Aretha, Mavis Staples, like all these people that came out, Dinah Washington, all came out of that. They all came out of that. He's just an important black musician. He's just an important black musician. But I came to a place in my life where I wanted to make a record like that and make it in a much more freewheeling, improvised way.
And was it? Was it rooted in your own spiritual background or whatever? Like, were you raised churchy or
Well, my grandfather was a bishop of the African Orthodox Church, so I do have some religious heavy roots on both sides. And I did go through some, around the time that I made Ivy Divey. And a few years before that, I went through a lot of religious refiguring of what I thought my spiritual thing was. And, I had studied Buddhism, transcendental meditation, I tried a few other things. And, I've come to a kind of peace with where I am, and I would say that I'm an African-American Christian,
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't exactly the Southern, my grandfather was my people are West Indian, so we didn't come up with the kind of Southern Baptist, with that kind of religion. Not exactly. So we had our own version of that. And then I kind of left that behind, and then I kind of just started studying gospel music, and then a lot of the contemporary artists, I studied their music, Hezekiah Walker, Kirk Franklin, Commission, Fred Hammond, and I was really excited by what those people were accomplishing, and really that they as opposed to the jazz thing where, like, it's like certain beats, that's not really jazz or whatever. They were just accessing the entire diaspora to make the music that they made, from P-Funk to some reggae shit to some Latin shit. Whatever they needed to access, they were accessing. That's what I really loved about what was happening in the idiom, you know, in the late 90s into 2000. I mean, that's a really high period for Kirk Franklin, for sure. And I you know, he's like the musician I look up to the most, not just in religious music, but just as a producer, as a harmonic sound, always very sophisticated, his arrangement flawless, his production flawless, the content interesting, exciting, you know, his command of the three-part gospel chorus, and his willingness to expand the voices of that, or, you know, like, he's very, very smart musician, interesting and smart musician. And so I really, along with my spiritual stuff, I was really looking at a lot of that music very seriously.
Mm-hmm. Recently, you did two different duo things. You did the one with Chris Davis on her record, and then you made this album with Arwan Ortiz in after, I guess you guys recorded that after a short run of live shows, right? So, I mean,
something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so talk to me a little bit about those, about first about Duopoly and then about, you know, the one with Arwan. Like, what are the, you know, what did you like about playing duo?
I just played on that a little bit. I mean, that was some kind of heavily supported thing, and it was a kind of an odd session. But I, you know, I'm just involved in a little bit of it, and you know, she's a good player. I was happy to play with her. And you know, the thing that we did with Arwan, we really just put that together out of, you know, stuff of mine and stuff of his and stuff he wanted to do and blah, blah, blah. And we've, you know, even since then, we've added a lot more Pixinguinha to our presentation as a duo and other kinds of things. But it's really a little, you know, very salon-like. There's something very third stream about that record, the kind of, you know, mix of things. It's a nice record, and he's a very fine pianist. He's a very good musician. So I don't know what else to say about that, except that, you know, that was really a pleasure to make.
Mm-hmm. And so what's next for you? Like, that was, 'cause that was 2018, but, you know, like you said, you recently played out with a quartet, you know, that he's part of. And then, so is there a record on the horizon from you, or some new music in some form or another? What do you got going on?
Well, I have a backlog of film music that I've never published that I'd like, you know, I'm kind of working at trying to just make a compilation of a couple of the different films that I've scored. And I guess probably some kind of quintet kind of thing would be next. I can't say that that's the first thing on my mind right this minute. I think things have to kind of smooth out a little bit more before I can really think about producing anything. But, you know, I don't mind, you know, getting together with people on a stage outdoors. I mean, that's fine. But, I don't know. Anyway, those would be the next few things that I'd be trying to get done.
Well, listen, thank you so much for talking to me, man. I really enjoyed it. It's you know, I think that what you do is like at least two steps to the left of what a lot of other people are doing, and so it's kind of fascinating to observe that and to see that, you know, that there's a space for that, you know, because this is something that I talked about with Braxton, you know, the other week, is that, you know, he talks about how people always accuse him of not being black enough, you know.
Well, that's a real big issue for me. I mean, I felt like I lost some black when I did the klezmer shit. That really fucked a lot of people up, but it also kept people from thinking, like, well, you know, is he a black musician? Am I like a valid black musician? And some of the kinds of gigs that I did before I did that, like, just completely disappeared. So I can kind of relate to that. You know, Braxton just pursued something very individual in a very direct and individual way to him. And people made assumptions about his blackness and his musicianship, which, you know, when you listen to the actual music, you kind of wonder where that's coming from. You know, somebody saying, well, you know, it's not real musicianship. It just shows you that there's certain kinds of slots in the music business that aren't just jazz or classical, that a lot of white folks fill, that a lot of black folks aren't supposed to fill, and that there's always confusion when you step out of the box of the two or three things that black folks are supposed to do. You're causing people actual discomfort or cognitive dissonance. They have to think about what kind of Negro you actually are. And I think when I did the klezmer shit, I got a lot of people that were just mad. You know, they felt betrayed that I would play something so popular. And also like a little bit of anti-Semitism. Like, I can't believe that you played that shit for those people. Or, you know, you're not, you know, somebody that was really down with the cause. We know you named your shit after Tuskegee experiments, but somebody that was really black would not do some shit like that. And yet, you know, and you know, white guys can do whatever they want. They can play whatever they want. Nobody's taking a peg off of them for doing what they want to do. You know, I have no regrets about doing some of the repertory things that I did, but even some people on the creative scene who should know better really were mad that I made bug music. Mad. They were mad that I made some music that people liked. Mad at me. I mean, like, real musicians, mad at me. They were mad at me. People whose bands I played in, and they were mad at me. So, I mean, you know, that just shows you that there's a kind of a narrow window of shit that we're supposed to do. And we're not supposed to reinvent ourselves. You know, yeah, I can't be like Buster Poindexter and then come back and be David Johansen. I had to be penalized for doing some shit that was off the list of what black people are supposed to do. Mm-hmm. But that all starts with the clarinet. It all starts with the clarinet, because the clarinet is that. It's not black money to make.
Right.
The clarinet is everybody knows, but nobody says out loud, but everybody knows I'm not supposed to be doing it. It's not black money to make.
I mean, the band that I always think about when people talk about, you know, limitations being placed on artists who are stepping out of their territory, you know, and it's not even, because I know Vernon Reed, you worked with, you know, many times for years and years, but it's not even Living Color. The band that I always think got the short end of the stick in a big way was Fishbone.
Fishbone, yeah. Well, yeah. Fishbone, I mean, you know, obviously Fishbone would be one of my favorites. But, you know, they had some crazy personnel problems that I think held them back. But they were uncategorizable. And, you know, to me, I like their versatility. And, you know, it was a band like Mandrill that I grew up with. As, you know, as a black person, I like to see black people be versatile. I like what Kevin Mitchell did for the Mets, where he played every position but pitcher and catcher. A black man, and hit 300. He's a big reason why the Mets won in 86, but he was versatile. And I love versatility. And you know, people just assume, like, white musicians are versatile as they say they are. But you look at a group like Mandrill, who could play real Latin, real funk, real rock, real doo-wop ballads, be real with them, and be versatile. That's, to me, what's the missing link in how people see black people. People see black musicians as having to be authentic. And usually authentic means one thing. You do one thing, you're real at it. White people experiment, black people are authentic. And it can be oppressive having to be authentic all the time. And what if you want to do something else? And that makes you inauthentic. Then you're inauthentic.
It's funny because I had like a weird sort of reckoning one time not that long ago because I was listening to a whole bunch of Louis Armstrong. And you get to the like the 1930s and 1940s when he's doing like cheesy novelty song after cheesy novelty song, you know, and he's having hit records and stuff, but you're like, you know, what is he doing? And then you realize that he likes that shit too, you know, that he doesn't want to just be this powerhouse hardcore trumpet player all the time.
You know, it's very, you know, somebody like Prince set himself up on purpose to do a lot of different things. But he started out doing some stuff that was kind of, you know, the shit that really got him over was this kind of white-centric, anthem-y rock shit. And then when he got himself set up that way, then he got funkier all of a sudden. But you have to, you know, it was like he decided to just appeal to the greatest number of people, start there, and then let the real greasy shit, that let that come out later. Now, is that, you know, he could consciously do that. But for those of us that are, we're just going through life, just doing what we're doing, you know, you can't really orchestrate how to have a multi-genre career. You know, you just, you know, you do what you're doing. You make your best effort at whatever it is that you happen to be doing. And, you know, a lot of times you're at the mercy of people that are just bothered that you would dare, or, you know, why aren't you just playing free jazz? Why aren't you just playing straight ahead jazz? You know, why aren't you just, you know, if something's effective, then you either like that kind of thing or you don't. And maybe you should disqualify yourself from talking about it if you don't know anything about it. Like, if you don't know anything about klezmer music, don't write about it. But, you know, if you're going to, somehow, because you write about jazz and I'm on your beat, you feel like you can write some negative shit about some shit you don't really know about. I didn't really appreciate that much. That seemed, you know, I had one guy that was a critic. He called me to ask me about the thing, and then he wrote some negative shit twisting what I said, which was the only thing that he knew about klezmer music, that I was always having to talk to people about music that they didn't know. You know, if I talk about Robert Schumann to a jazz critic, the thing that he'll never admit is that he don't know a lot of shit about Robert Schumann. But he can't admit that I know something that he doesn't. So instead, I'm a weird guy. You know, he can't, yeah. You know, the critic can't admit that he don't know, that I know something about Jewish music that he don't know. So I'm a crazy guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was really the narrative in that period, was like, oh, that's really crazy because I don't know anything about it. And now those people wouldn't say that. Now they can say, well, now I know about it. But back then, it was like, that's really crazy. But really, the main thing is, I don't know about it, and he does. You know, a lot of what music is about is who has the overview, who's looking down from above, you know, authentizing or de-authentizing some shit. And I think black musicians are always looked down. Somebody's always looking down and telling you what kind of black person you should be or you are, what you should do, what you shouldn't do, what's in your wheelhouse, what you don't, what you isn't attractive, you doing. You're always being judged on those things in a way that, you know, white artists really don't get that. You don't see that, you know. You don't see people just not taking it seriously that you're doing what you're doing.
Right, right.
Okay, that was my conversation with Don Byron, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and if so, I hope you'll consider becoming a subscriber at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and you will get exclusive content and other perks for your money. So visit patreon.com/burningambulance and throw us $5 a month if you can. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.